Greetings and good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Wednesday, April 11, 2018. The dogwoods are beginning to bloom here in Nashville, and as usual, we are experiencing a little bit of a cold spell, which hopefully will be the last sign of winter. I am anticipating visiting the farmers market this weekend to purchase vegetables for the summer garden. I had a wonderful experience yesterday sitting down to interview my old friend Bobby Fulcher. Bob is a 40-year veteran of the Tennessee State Parks Division. He presently serves as the park manager of the Cumberland Trail. However, Bob is most well known for his activities as a folklorist. Back in the late 1970s, he was instrumental in the founding of the Tennessee State Parks Folklife Project. Continuing up through the 1990s, Bobby and his associates worked to document folk customs across Tennessee, using the parks as their base of operation. As you can imagine, this covered a wide array of interests, including music, storytellers, folk games, and handicrafts of all sorts. So Bob joined me yesterday to recount a little of the history of that program, as well as to discuss his current work on the Cumberland Trail, and to do a little bit of promotion about a special concert that has been scheduled here in Nashville for May 19th at TPAC. So I hope you'll enjoy listening to my interview with my old friend Bob Fulcher. So Bob Fulcher, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Well, it's so good to be here.
Bob, it's terrific to have you. I remember sitting down and when I was envisioning doing this podcast a year and some ago, I made a list of the people that I thought would be appropriate to interview, and you were on that list. And so I appreciate finally being able to get together with you.
Well, this is a first for me, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, Bobby, you know, it's coincidental, I guess, that we're getting together today, because I know you're promoting an upcoming concert, and I want to talk about that in more detail later. But at the very beginning, mention it, in May the 19th at TPAC, there's going to be a concert which we're calling Crossing the Cumberlands, which I guess is a benefit for the Cumberland Trail.
That's right. Okay. It's being sponsored by the Friends of the Cumberland Trail, a nonprofit organization that helps us in areas that must have help in the maintenance of our trails, in the protection of our natural resources, the protection of our historic resources. I don't think there's a long-distance trail anywhere in the world that manages without that kind of organizational support and support from everyone who loves that trail, those regions. There are none that are just sponsored by a government agency somewhere.
Well, you've got a cast of characters that will be appearing at that performance, 7 o'clock on the 19th of May.
Oh, it is an astounding assembly of professional musicians from Nashville, great musicians who have an understanding and who honor tradition and heritage, who want to be there to play some of this musical pieces that came from the Cumberlands and affected their musical lives. But we also are bringing the real deal, people from those heritage lines, from those lines of tradition, into Nashville for the first time.
Okay.
There'll be several performing on a stage for the first time ever, but their music they're bringing is going to be from way back, from the late 18th century, 19th century, and it's music, much of it has just not ever been played on a stage like this.
All right, so we've teased our audience a little bit now with that, and we're going to come back to that and play some music a little later and talk about it. But for the benefit of our audience and there are people all over the country who don't know anything about Tennessee State Parks and the Folklife Program, Bob, I first met you, I think, 78 or 79, when you were just kind of getting started with that program, I believe. Tell us about the history of the Tennessee State Park Folklife Project. How did it get started?
Well, you know, I was a young guy from Florida when I moved to Tennessee, went to college. I started to meet people who played traditional music, Tennessee's traditional music, and very soon was taken out to meet people in the country, in East Tennessee, who played music from their family tradition. And so I was hired to work in Tennessee State Parks as a seasonal naturalist.
In which park were you started?
At Pickett State Park.
At Pickett, way up in the country, okay.
Well, I had learned from one of my friends, all you have to do is take your banjo and knock on a door, and they're going to let you in. And that's exactly what happened. And I started to meet musicians, record musicians, and I sent a list of my recordings eventually to the Library of Congress. They said, we want to loan you some equipment. And wow. I got an equipment loan from the Library of Congress Archive of Folk Song, it was still called, I think, at that time. And and made recordings then. So I became fascinated and devoted to the traditional music of the Cumberland Mountains early on. And when I was hired full-time in Tennessee State Parks in 1977, things were happening in the country. In Washington, D.C. had begun the National Endowment for the Arts Folk Arts Program. The Library of Congress had just started this this Folklife Center, the American Folklife Center, from whom I got that loan of equipment. And so I went to Memphis to ask, they were holding a workshop for the new folk arts program about their grant program. Boy, I took some notes, went back and wrote a grant and got a grant to start in 1979. A project through Tennessee State Parks that allowed us to hire three folklorists that came out of graduate programs of folklore studies. And we had one in East, one in Middle, and one in West Tennessee. They lived in the state parks, and from those bases, they went out into the communities and trying to document traditional arts around them. Some of it was music, some of it was were material arts.
Basket making, that sort of thing.
Oh, yes, boat making, bow making, so many things that people
archery
boat
did. Type yes. making, Any, pottery, I believe there was
yes,
some.
Yes, yeah. Oh, an enormous span of traditional art was documented.
Now, Bobby, you know, it's remarkable, you did this in the Blanton years. So this was Governor Blanton's term of office when this was initiated. I remember there was a fellow by the name of Miller,
Jack Miller.
Jack Miller was the head of the state parks at the time.
That's right, and director.
It's a remarkable innovation that they, things were pretty scarce in state parks at those times. Having resources to do projects was rare.
Well, we used some of our grant money to buy a PA system. I think it was the first one that Tennessee State Parks ever have, and I still have pieces of it, you know, to use if times go lean again. We're still using a few pieces of equipment from those days.
So name some of the people that were involved in as the East and West. And
oh, certainly, yeah. Certainly. You know, we did this for several years with that format. And the first year, we had a young man named Jay Orr. He became vice president at the Country Music Hall of Fame, and it still works there, directing programs and exhibits. He's been a very senior leader at the Country Music Hall of Fame for decades. Before that, he worked at the Library of Congress a little bit as well. We had Elaine Lawless in that first year. She went on to be a professor at University of Missouri, is honored there. A book is coming out on their press of all her writings, and she was president of the American Folklore Society, became very prominent. And then dear friend Ray Allen, Dr. Ray Allen, who's taught ethnomusicology at Brooklyn College for decades.
My goodness.
That was just year one. And year two, Betsy Peterson worked her first job as a folklorist with us. And now she is the director of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress.
My goodness.
So,
you know, I know from talking with you that the materials that you gathered, which would consist of photographs, slides, and real-to-reel tape, but cassette tape recordings.
Well, real-to-reel.
There were some real tape as well?
Continually,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Pardon me. Now, those have all been gathered up from the period of 77 to 90?
Well, up till 1999,
okay.
You know, we continued to work through Tennessee State Parks to document people. And since then, as I was transferred to the Cumberland Trail Project, we have continued to work throughout the Cumberlands to document our people, sometimes with the same recording equipment that we have.
Right. The point I was trying to make is the materials have now been assembled and provided to the Tennessee Library and Archives for safekeeping, I presume.
Right, and the State Library and Archives has processed a portion of that collection,
right.
Not nearly all of it, but the portion that they have made some of that available online, snippets of conversation, beautiful images that were photographed by these folklorists and
If our listeners want to listen, if they go to the Tennessee Library and Archives digital collection and search for Tennessee State Parks, this will show up.
Tennessee State Parks Folklife Project
is
the formal name of that collection.
And I've looked at it and listened to some of the recordings. There's not nearly enough of it been processed. So you may be disappointed in how much is there and how much is not there. But are they continuing to make efforts to get those digitized?
Oh, I feel very confident it will all be digitized eventually. Now, they're distracted because, of course, the archives has a new home
down by
the Bicentennial Mall.
Exactly.
And so they have all hands on deck in making that transition right at this moment.
Right.
But Wayne Moore is a folklorist. He's the deputy archivist, I believe, for the state of Tennessee. And others at the TSLA are very committed. They're very proud of this collection of Tennesseans' voices. And I don't know if there is a broader collection of Tennesseans' voices in any archive in our state.
Well, it's really worth dialing up and listening to. I certainly would recommend that. You know, it occurs to me to go back and talk about the programming in this Tennessee State Parks that your investigations sort of gave birth to. And one of the prominent ones that comes to mind, there's a couple that come to mind. One is the Roly Hole Marbles Tournament. And for our listeners, would you tell us about what's going on in Roly Hole Marbles?
Well, people have fun in life, and there's an area on the Tennessee-Kentucky border where marbles are still played by men. If you look at the evidence of how marble games were played in Tennessee, you will find many documents, photographs principally, that document the men, the old men, gathering at a marble playing area, playing a variety of games. And they were played with marbles that were made in creeks, ground out on stone by hand, with a dozen different methods to create a round sphere from flint or limestone. And so when I first saw a African-American blues player named Bud Garrett with a marble machine in downtown Nashville, I was fascinated, kept it in mind, talked to him.
I remember seeing him at Standing Stone.
Yeah. But he was at the Grassroots Festival by the Parthenon, invited because he was a blues man. He decided on his own he wanted to show off his marble-making machine. And so when I had a folklorist ready to work in that area, I suggested get with Bud Garrett. And that was Betsy Peterson, again, now director at the Library of Congress. And she organized the first effort to have a marble game at Standing Stone. It got rained out, but we carried on. We built a traditional marble yard, or the local players did, in our park. It is still there.
A little shed sort of a building.
That's right.
With a dirt floor.
Well, it is special dirt.
Special dirt. Pardon me.
It has been gathered from the banks of the Cumberland River.
Oh, I see.
It is a loam from a river loam, sifted, because that dirt has to have exactly the right feel and texture to suit these marble players.
I don't want to go too far without describing the marble making machine that this fellow had.
Oh, it was a crazy looking contraption, but it's pretty simple. It was a wheel, a grind wheel spinning that allows the marble inside another abrasive cup that could be stone, it could be other grindstone.
But he had it on a stand or a cart of some sort, and it was a box, a 2x2 box.
Oh,
and
yes.
And it had writing on the outside, marble machine or something.
He had it fixed up to draw attention to it.
Right.
You better believe it.
Right.
And love to talk. Bud Garrett was an amazing personality and musician. He was just honored at last year's event with his family coming again to Standing Stone, and a blues player from Nashville coming up to honor Bud by singing.
Now, this is always in September, as I recall.
Yes,
at Standing Stone State Park.
Usually about the third weekend in September.
And this will be like the 38th or 39th.
Started in 1983.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the first year of the tournament.
Right.
And it's been covered by ESPN. They sponsored a tournament, in fact, there. CBS, ABC, Sports Illustrated, all have been there and made their pilgrimage, because it's not a joke. It's not like a cow chip throwing contest. These people have spent their life learning to shoot a marble the right way and control that thing. And it is an amazing thing to see.
A roly hole, as I recall, is a court probably 15 or 20 yards long and 10 yards wide, and it has three half-circle holes different positions along the way.
That's right. My belief is that croquet is a descendant in itself of an early marble game, where marbles were rolled into holes in certain positions while you battle people away from their achieving the course, going through the course, just like in croquet. And these battles, they can last for a couple hours before they're finished.
There's no money that changes hands.
Well, we give money prizes, and did from day one.
So no betting of any kind.
I think there has been.
Okay.
There have been, in the oral history of marble playing, a few marble yard deaths, in fact.
Oh, no. Not that. Oh, goodness. Well, I tell you, I remember attending the first of those events, and it was quite a thing to see. And
yes.
I recommend to our audience, if you're in the neighborhood of Livingston, Tennessee, which is Standing Stone area, it's definitely worth. Now, Standing Stone's worth visiting anyway, but this is a fun event, and it's an outcome of our Tennessee Folklife Project.
It certainly is, and it's something that's shared throughout the world. We've invited marble traditions from around the world to be presented there, and have done so. Our marble players have gone to England and played in their World Cup. Tinsley Green won it, of course.
Wow.
Went live on CNN with their truck when they came out champions.
So that is a funny thing. And I saw on the internet recently somebody in New Jersey that has a some sort of a tournament there at the boardwalk or something in New Jersey, and to qualify to come to Tennessee to the national championships.
Well, it's a little different than that. Now, okay. That tournament up there is an old tournament for kids.
Okay.
Kids up to the age of 13.
Okay.
And it's gone on since the 1920s.
Wow.
Now, they play the ring marble game, and sort of an urban style of marble game on concrete.
Okay. Wow.
Great players, you know, can be made from young kids that get involved in that,
right,
with these little marble teaching programs that you have on the East Coast, principally. So we've become acquainted, and we've mixed together, and our players from the hills of Tennessee and Kentucky go there and play their game, and they come down and sometimes play our
That's
game.
That's terrific fun. Now, to change paces just a little bit, one of the other notable things to come from the Tennessee Folklife Project, State Parks Folklife Project, were the exhibits that are presented in many of our state park museums and visitor centers and that sort of thing. And the one that comes to mind is the Museum of the Tennessee River Culture.
Oh, yes. That is a beautiful exhibit and opportunity to understand the Tennessee River. It's in Park, Nathan Bedford Forest State Park, that was named a long time ago, but really the most significant thing in that area wasn't the battle that occurred across the river and on the river, but the whole story of the Tennessee River. And so we had an opportunity to fill that thing up with the story of the Tennessee River as represented by people who had lived their lives there. And Tom Rankin became the folklorist who had worked in the Tennessee State Parks Folklife Project, who we hired to work on that. I got to work on it for about a year or two in doing the field work.
This is a museum site that's a small building. It's on prominent hilltop there in the park.
It's on Pilot Knob, the high point on the Tennessee River,
right,
which was, of course, a landmark for river people. If you were log rafting or if you were in a boat, you could see Pilot Knob. You knew right where you were on that river course. And the music, the material culture, the occupational life of people who were mustlers, pearl sellers, fishermen, of course, Maggie Sayer, who lived on a houseboat through almost her whole life and photographed it through a wild happenstance of being sent to the Kentucky School for the Deaf by a wealthy woman. And there she learned, first of all, that she had a name, because she didn't know it, that she didn't know she had one. And then Kodak had a promotion in 1936 or thereabouts to give cameras to school children. She received a camera from her sister, who also was deaf and went there, and then she photographed her life on the Tennessee River from the perspective of a houseboat family.
Wow.
There's nothing else like it in the historical record. It is entirely unique. And you, Maggie Sayer, got to travel the country presenting her story and her photographs.
Documenting a total way of life
that's
that
right,
some people lived in those
hidden
days
from almost all the rest of America.
Right. This
that's
reminds
right
me of the Tammy Tell Me Truly stories of the people that lived on the houseboat in the swamp somewhere.
Right.
Right. The well, that museum is quite a masterpiece. In the middle of it is one of the muscling boats, as I recall, and there's opportunities to see videos that have been taken of your interviews, as I recall, of different people there about their lives.
Interviews that I did some. Tom Rankin did the majority of those, and
okay,
he is now the director, for 20 years he's been the director of the Duke Center for Documentary Studies, which is the only graduate program in America for documentary studies.
Wow.
He is a
wow
eminent documentarian.
Well, Bob, now you have gone through quite a journey in 40 years of being in the state park system. From the ranger naturalist to folklorist, you're now a park manager. Tell us what your duties are, and where you're stationed now.
Well, in late 1999, I went to the Cumberland Trail Project as it was being revived through the work of a nonprofit organization through the Tennessee Trails Association and a subgroup called the Cumberland Trail Conference. And they revitalized that project, which had been abandoned by the state. And we have made great progress since that time. We now do have a Tennessee State Park staff. Initially, I was the only state park person that was on the program. And now we have a wonderful staff of professional rangers, and work with many organizations. The Cumberland Trails Conference has become the Cumberland Trails Conference. Okay. The Tennessee Trails Association is still working with this, and many others, the Friends of the Cumberland Trail, organizations in Chattanooga, still in Nashville, that we're going to honor at our concert, like Ten Green, the Nature Conservancy, the Land Trust for Tennessee. All of those organizations have helped create and sustain the Cumberland Trail.
Now the Cumberland Trail starting in the southern portion, right down in the Chattanooga area.
That's right. Well, our endpoints.
Okay.
I use plural because we have two of them.
Okay.
One, the historic one, is in Prentice Cooper State Forest, okay, right by the Tennessee River Gorge, where the Tennessee River, as huge as it is in the East Tennessee Valley, it breaks through the plateau and comes out on the other side of the plateau. You know, it goes down through Alabama, Mississippi, and comes heading north then to Kentucky, of course. That is one of our endpoints. The other is at Signal Point, Point Park, which is a National Park Service area.
And then right there in Chattanooga, right.
Just above Chattanooga, right. Signal Mountain. And right. And our northern terminus, of course, is at Cumberland Gap, another National Park Service area.
And how much of the trail is now complete or constructed?
Well, we have in terms of the linear miles we expect to use, we've got right around 200 of those in place.
Okay.
Now, we have other miles of trail that are loop trails and access trails that go into our system that give us more mileage than that's on the ground. But we still have another 100 miles that we have to build out before we know that we've got what we need in our system.
Now, is this trail all on state-owned property, or is it some of it on leased land, or just handshake agreement to come across here? What, tell us about all that.
Well, it's been a great adventure acquiring the corridor and legal rights to our corridor through across a 300-mile long trail. And the great majority will be owned and under the management of the state of Tennessee, with Tennessee State Parks and the Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency and the Division of Forestry, being those three state entities that are all landholders. And beyond that, of course, we're on National Park Service land. So our...
That would be Obed National Scenic River area?
Cumberland Gap National Historical Park.
Okay.
Obed Wild and Scenic River.
Okay.
And then, of course, Chattanooga, Chickamauga National Battlefield has Point Park.
So those are National Park Service areas, right?
That's right. And of course, this got designated in 1971 by the state legislature as a state scenic trail. And that's what gives us the authority to have this entity on top of a national park. We're not a state park there, right, but we are a state scenic trail, right, when we're inside an area like that. We do have just a very few areas that the trail is on that it's on by consent by the landowner, but it is not in pu- public ownership, and the state scenic trail law allows for that as well.
Right, right. So you're going to we're going to have a concert, which is a fundraiser for these activities.
Yes, and it will be a very extraordinary night. This is not an ordinary concert. It's going to be a unique night of music, again, representing the places in the Cumberland Mountains, the landscapes in the Cumberland Mountains, as they are depicted in the region's historic music and original music, some of it traditional, some of it showing, again, that human instinct to make new things, but again, to honor what's seen. Some of the great traditional music is centuries old, but it still relates to the life and the place in the Cumberland.
All right, so I want to play some of this music for our audience and let you talk about it a little bit. What is the first thing you want to play for us?
Well, I'd like for you to take a listen to a style of music that we're going to present, and we won't share everything, but there was a period when there weren't guitars on the frontier, and there weren't banjos, except in the hands of those people who were enslaved, who had the banjo from their African ancestry. But there were fiddles. The fiddle was the instrument of our Tennessee frontier. And so when you hear a fiddle tune these days, you might hear something that sounds predictable or simplistic, or you might be a good enough listener to hear in it grand architecture. But certainly in the frontier period, there were pieces created with a grand architecture because they weren't constrained by any rules. And just like the classical musicians of that time, Beethoven and Chopin and others, they used music to paint pictures. That's called program music, but in the classical world. And what's found in our heritage are pieces created by people we'll never know who they were, but we're doing the same thing that those great composers were. Some of it turned into classical music.
Okay.
Everybody knows Hoedown, I think, if they've ever listened to public radio or anything. And one of the main themes in Copland's piece that he called Hoedown, it's become a meat commercial, but this is what it sounds like.
All right. Of course, that was Aaron Copland's
right version
of comes from Hoedown. Was it from Appalachian Spring?
Yes,
right.
From Appalachian Spring, and that was that's a very recognizable piece out of that operatic ballet, and it came from a field recording made in Kentucky, in the Kentucky Cumberlands, by a man born in a rock house, Bill Stepp. He was recorded by Alan Lomax in 1937, and you need
to... Of course, Lomax is famous for
his
traveling around doing recordings of country folk and...
blues, many different...
The father of American folklore, I guess.
Right, and certainly one of the greatest documentarians and... preservationists of the sounds of America. And so this was one sound that he documented, and it came from, again, a man who was born in a rock house, lived a life in poverty and joy.
Tell us what a rock house is. It's not a house built out of rocks.
No, it's a bluff that has been weathered to create a roof and really a room. And
sort of a cave.
Yes. Yeah. One of the musical families that we will have at our event had an aunt. Their aunt gave birth to a son in a rock house.
Okay.
That family will be with us at TPAC.
Which family is that?
The Hicks family.
Okay.
That's right. But back to the fiddle music.
Okay.
Let's listen to Bill Stepp and how he played that.
All right.
When that piece was put together in the early 19th century, a piece of program music. The piece goes on to, and in other playings of it that are in tradition, to have other sound effects, marching, hurrying, and that kind of fiddling has mostly vanished, but its great period was our early period in Tennessee music. We have one family with a descendant still living, carrying a great body of these tunes. His name is Clyde Davenport, and Clyde is almost 97. He cannot come to this, but his two fiddlers have mentored with him for several years. One of those will be here, a 15-year-old, a little fiddling savant, and he is going to play some of those grand pieces of architecture, and along with another fiddler who has learned Clyde's fiddling to present pieces that have never been heard in this town on a stage. This is an opportunity to understand something about Tennessee's musical traditions that most people don't know anything about. In the early record, there was a fiddler in Nashville, early Nashville, the late 18th century, and he is described in the historical record doing just what you heard, playing tunes that described life all around him. We want people to hear such music. We'll also be bringing balladry here that goes to the founding of Nashville. There is only one song, an American folk song, anywhere, that describes a frontier experience of crossing into a wilderness with detail of what was seen and experienced. That song is carried by one family in America, the Hicks family, and they are coming to Nashville for the first time to sing that song at TPAC to describe crossing in 1789 from the Tennessee Valley in East Tennessee across the plateau, driving oxen, seeing the wonders, expressing the fears, expressing the hope of coming to Nashville in 1789. Anybody that wants to hear a little piece of music history, I think this is some of it.
I listened to this last night, and I'll play it here for our audience, but it's so descriptive of, as you say, all the different circumstances that they encountered.
The Indians
and all of that.
The mounds that they saw, they didn't understand. They didn't know
what
was
going on.
The burial mounds.
Exactly.
And it's in this song. There is nothing else like it in our folk song tradition.
All right, let's play a little bit of that.
The day I parted away from you in sorrow, grief, grief and in trouble too. You gave to me the parting hand, and you reached me safe in old Cumberland land. Oh, I took the steer in my hand, and I stared through ice, and I stared through sand. Oh, I took the steer in my hand, and we steered our way through the Cumberland land. But when we got here, it was ice and snow, and it rained, it hailed, and the winds did blow, which caused us all for to weep and cry, saying, here with cold, we almost die. But thank the Lord, good help we found. We all got here, both safe and sound. And it's here in peace, it's we hope to be, with the Indian tribes in old Tennessee. Now I found 500 human graves, all walled in with Freemason signs, which have made me think in former days, some human race hath passed this place. Now I've nothing strange to write to you, preaching this case and religion too. We've a happy land with a fertile soil, and we've honey and milk, here is corn and oil.
Well, that is, I guess, the world's oldest tradition, and that is telling your story by singing it. And this will be extraordinary. The Hicks family has a monument at the Bicentennial Mall. At the Court of Three Stars, there are monuments to 100 of Tennessee's most important musicians, whether it's Elvis Presley, Dolly Parton, I think she made it in there, or the great classical musicians from our state. The Hicks family, D and Delta Hicks, are represented in that group. They were important to this world. And so I do hope that folks in Nashville will have an opportunity, will take the opportunity to experience this sort of getting toward the end of this centuries and centuries of tradition.
Gotcha.
Traditional singing. Now, we've got stuff that's not what you'd call traditional, but it's born from tradition.
Okay.
That's going to happen at this concert that we're extremely excited about and so proud to put on. Some of it's going to be led by great musical minds of our age. One of those, Jerry Douglas.
Jerry Douglas.
That guy has reinvented his instrument, the resinphonic guitar.
Also He's known as the Dobro to many people.
That's one brand. Jerry has played every kind of music that people can get a hold of him to play, because he plays everything. His mind is boundless, but he is going to play there both very beautiful, progressive, original music, along with music that he relates to from his own family's connection with the Cumberland region.
Now, what is that connection?
Well, it's north of where most of our artists are from, but some of his family that he loved and admired and was with continually is West Virginian.
Okay, gotcha.
And Jerry lived on the Ohio side, but he values his life with his family from the Cumberlands and the time that he spent there. And he is going to be a great presenter with some of the artists who are playing and presenting music that's meaningful to him in relationship to this region. And a couple other musicians that are that are like that, that are master musicians, the best that we have in our generation on their instruments, you know, among the best, certainly, would be Stuart Duncan, a master fiddle player who he gets called to play on everybody's records, and he can do it. But here he's going to focus on some pieces that have, some of them have been played around the world by the Boston Pops Orchestra or whatever, but they are from our region. They represent our landscapes and our places. And then Alan O'Brien, who was with the Nashville Bluegrass Band like Stuart Duncan was, and that band has gone on for 30 years or so. But they've played with everybody. They've written for everybody and created. And they're going to represent some of the great historic music of the Cumberlands with their hands and somewhat with their ideas, too. We have other folks from our region who are wonderful creators. And an example of that would be Wade Hill, who continually writes his own music. He comes out of the Hicks family as well, from the Cumberlands. His mother was descended out of the Hickses, and his grandmother was a Hicks in Scott County. And he plays a wild, relentless, unpredictable banjo, from the mellowest, gentlest music to some of the most raving and ravishing sounds that you could ever hear come out of a banjo. And Scotty Anderson will be there.
Okay.
And Jerry Douglas is very much looking forward, I think, to playing with Scotty, and Scotty feels the same way.
Now, does Scotty play the fiddle as well, or does he play guitar?
Scotty plugs in and plays a Telecaster.
Oh, wow. Electric guitar.
Scotty does not have a peer in the world of Telecaster mastery.
Wow.
There is no, in some respects, everybody loves their kind of music, and Scotty has created his own. His grandfather was Virgil Anderson, lived in one of the most remote home places that I ever visited and recorded, and I got to go with Virgil to Carnegie Hall, where Virgil sat up there on that stage, and Carnegie Hall said, "This is the finest place, most beautiful place I've ever seen to put up cut roughness and corn fodder." And they didn't know what he meant. But he was a master banjo player. Now his grandson, like Virgil Anderson, has created ways of playing that no one else can do. They can't handle it. You'll find Scotty on the internet to see some of the places he goes, but he's going to play in
Scotty Anderson.
Scotty Anderson,
okay. All right.
Is a cult hero in the guitar world.
Okay.
He doesn't tour. Most people don't know him. The people who know him are good guitarists,
yeah.
Great
right.
guitarists,
right.
Or the greatest guitarists,
right.
And they know him. And
that's,
he's going to be here representing his family.
Now, you know, one of the names that stuck out to me, and we talked about this earlier, was Leroy Troy.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll never forget seeing a video that he did with Marty Stewart, and his song was Ghost Chickens in the Sky. It's sort of made up after the Ghost Riders in the Sky song that was so popular. Do you remember this one?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So he's going to be there. But you were telling me that he has his roots in the same vein.
Well, you know, he was raised in Middle Tennessee, but early on he got to meet an old-timer named Cordell Kemp, who didn't live on the plateau, but right at the edge of just, excuse me, on the Highland Rim area. But he fell in with music from this region. He's going to represent an Uncle Dave Macon piece,
right,
written about one of our communities and the Scopes Trial.
Oh, boy.
And there's nobody that can bring that music better than Leroy Troy.
He's and a storyteller,
so
for sure.
He's the man we're going to have there,
right,
to present that piece of our history.
That's just fun. Lots of fun. So, all right. So, reminding people, May 19th at Tennessee Performing Arts Center.
Yes.
Tickets are already available.
They are.
They are. So if you get online, you can order your tickets, and encourage everyone to look it up.
Yes.
And to participate. You will not be disappointed.
Well, there won't be another concert like this, I don't imagine, ever on a stage like this. I don't know how there could be. It will be a special opportunity to see and hear some music that can't be made again. I guess that happens in a lot of concert performances. Folks come together for only one time. This will be special if you care about the Cumberlands, if you care about music traditions, if you care about rockabilly. You need to be here.
All right, terrific. Bob, thank you so much for joining us today. It's
been
a pleasure.
Thanks so much.